Well, this is going to be in the spirit of some of the talks which I've really enjoyed here, and particularly given the mixed nature of the audience, especially at the beginning, it's going to be a bit of a review of ideas and goals. So I apologize to a couple of people early on for the pace, but keep me honest, ask me questions, all that good stuff. So when looking at disordered systems, like if you take liquid crystals like John kind of talked about yesterday, and you or some other very nice system, which is very nice and pure, and you learn a lot of beautiful physics about this, a lot of symmetry, a lot of things you can do. Now, what if you take something, a beautiful system like liquid crystals, and you make some really nasty material like an aerogel or something like this, which is just extremely porous, and you take this beautiful thing and you stuff it in there and you ask what happens. I mean, a lot of us work on this area. We know what these questions are about, but I just want to review because we want to ask what symmetries are left when you really put a lot of disorder into a system. What type of principles can you use to understand this system? And how can you classify these highly disordered these systems with a high amount of quench disorder? And there are a couple of ways. You can look at it from a physics point of view and do classification by exponents. Try to find universality classes, things that have a similar behavior that scale in the same fashion. But over the past 30 years or so, people have realized that a lot of it can be connected with issues in computational complexity. So people have tried to use ideas from computation also to address those issues. So that's what I'm going to look at is what problems can you solve efficiently and fast. So there are some problems which I'll talk about, matching in particular, that you can solve very quickly and efficiently on a computer. And besides just finding solutions to these physical questions, one of the things we find is that there's a lot of connections between the running times of algorithms and the physics of the problem. In fact, towards the end, I'm going to talk a bit about some coarsening phenomena that you see in algorithms that is not directly physical coarsening, but is related in some way, at least through length scales. So I'll get to explain the title about halfway through the talk, for those who don't understand where I'm coming from on that yet. But I wanted to just mention some of the collaborators that I've worked with over the years on this, and like I say, a lot of it's an overview, so there's a lot of connections here to different people. And I'm going to focus quite a bit on work that I've done in particular, because I'm most familiar with it, but there's some related work by several very good groups, Matteo Palacini and Peter Young, Heiko Rieger, Alexander Hartman has done some very nice large range of simulations on issues related to what I'm talking about here. So I'll try to get some references along the way to other people's work also. So as I said, I want to start out simple, so let's do that. Now if you go to MapQuest or MapBlast and you ask, what is the, how do you get from one point to the other? And if, for those of you who haven't really done the research, what used to be called MapBlast but has now been taken over by Microsoft and is now called MapPoint, actually always gives you a faster route than MapQuest on paper. They compute that you're driving faster, so if you want to get there faster, go here. But if what they do is they say you want to get from Syracuse to Santa Barbara by road rather than by plane, it's about 2,811 miles, how you go to MapQuest and you type it in and it gives you a route that it claims is the optimal route, either by time or distance, it's your choice. How does that work? And it's the shortest paths problem. Now if you're a physicist and you say, well, this looks like a line object, and I'm going to simulate it using Monte Carlo or simulated annealing or something like this in order to find the optimal route, what I might do is start with some really crazy route, some randomly chosen route, that's this red line here, that doesn't look like the real thing, and I let it fluctuate. I kick it with thermal fluctuation so that it'll settle down, and then I slowly cool it so that it'll settle down to a low energy state. That's what you might do in a real experiment. This is what people do with computers and various versions of simulated annealing or tempering, for example. And so after a while, you might get a route that looks something like this, and maybe it's a local minima. As we know, these come up a lot in disordered systems. You get stuck in some local minima, and it's hard to find the true ground state. So local minima, local means that if you think of simple moves raise the energy. So first you start out, and if you have a very convoluted route, you say, oh, if I take this path and I replace it with this path, that immediately shortens my route. And so you keep on doing that for a while, and a greedy algorithm will always try simple moves to lower your total energy. And you, particularly with a greedy algorithm, you might get stuck in something like this. I don't know if this is actually a local algorithm. Oh, it looks roughly like a metastable state. And that this path has an energy that if you try to modify the path a little bit, it goes up in energy a little bit. So this is why energy in this context being the time, the total length of the route.
And the notion of being locally in a minimum then depends on the moves that you're allowed to take.
Absolutely. So what moves you're allowed to take. And so people spend time in doing simulated annealing trying to find more sophisticated set of moves so that you can lower, so you tend not to get stuck in a metastable point. Or at least you have to change the definition of what a metastable point is so you get closer to the true minimum. But, you know, as a common feature of all these things, they're very good for small problems, simulated annealing and so on. But when you go to very large problems, you get stuck in a minima that's not the global minima. And you might, one of the issues that comes out of this, as we've talked about already so far, is the true minimum really what you want to find for physical purposes? Maybe you want to find the local minima for physical purposes. But for this talk, because that's actually what the system finds, is a local minima. But I'm going to assume here that nature is much faster than us, and we want to take all the advantage we can in doing the simulations to find the best minimum we possibly can, and then worry about those details later. As you often do in this example, you do.
In the example of trying to get from point A to point B, you don't care if you lose the global minimum. You're going to have.
That's right. That's right. Here you really want the global minimum. And so the computer scientists over the years have found lots of ways to be optimal, to various optimization algorithms. And so they went and approached this problem this way using simulated annealing, as we know. So let me remind you of what the algorithm to find the shortest path would be, because this is the type of algorithm we'll be considering. And I want to raise a couple of issues, though this work is very old, particularly if you think back to Hughes and Henley, which was, 86, 87? Anyway. There's some nice applications of this, but let's start out. How does MapQuest work? Because it doesn't work by simulated annealing. It works by a much more efficient method, something that's guaranteed to find the ground state quickly. What you do is you start. Yes.
So there is traveling salesman program.
Yes.
So is it just 2-point traveling salesman?
This is not the 2-point traveling salesperson. Well, the traveling salesperson problem is a loop. For one thing, and so it's the optimal loop, and that actually changes things. Plus, you have to visit every city. Here, you don't visit every city.
No, just one.
The traveling salesperson would be: you give me a set of cities, and I want to visit exactly those cities in some order that minimizes the total length of the route. Here, I'm not specifying that I have to visit all of the cities.
So you only specify the final.
I only specify the initial and the final point.
So then it's just one point.
No, because
what complexity is there?
No, because in the usual
problem. That's right. Yeah, no. So a 2-point traveling salesperson would be: I have Santa Barbara and Syracuse, and I have one road between them, and I can't deviate from that road. And then it's straightforward. That's right. So for small cases, you can solve it. That's true in 1850. There's one railroad. Okay. But here, I don't have to visit every city, and I want to find the shortest route, rather than shortest route that visits all of the cities.
So is it the same level of complexity or not?
No, this is polynomial time, as I'll discuss in a second. So this is solvable very rapidly, finding the shortest path, whereas traveling salesperson is not. Okay, so what you do, how MapQuest or MapBlast works, is say, okay, you want to get from Santa Barbara to Syracuse. What you do is you start out by finding the nearest city to Santa Barbara. You have some set of maps and roads. This is a graph problem, and you think of each of these nodes, intersections, each of these intersections as a node, and there's some distance between them. And so you find the nearest one, which in this case happens to be L.A.
And you can go by cities.
Intersection. So Oklahoma City here is an intersection. So the nodes in this graph are going to be the intersections. It happens that some nodes are cities.
Some aren't.
And some aren't.
And MapQuest knows that.
And MapQuest knows that. MapQuest goes by. That's right. It doesn't insist that you go through cities. It would go by traveling times between intersections. So wherever there's a branch in the road and you can choose, those are the points that, those are the nodes that make up your graph, and the roads that connect those points are the edges in the graph. So what you do is you start out at your start node, and you find the nearest point, the shortest road out of that city. Get me out of here as quickly as possible. And you find that, and that's Los Angeles in this case. And you've started to construct the path that will take you to Syracuse. Okay, what's the next step? Well, you look at the cities you've visited, cities or nodes or intersections that you've visited so far, in this case Santa Barbara and Los Angeles, and you find, given this set, what are those that have minimal total distance from your start location? So I should have included this line here or something like this to this intersection, which I didn't do. So you say, okay, look at the next, I'm going to give you just a kind of intuitive sense and I can make it more precise. It's very easy to make it precise. I look at the next nearest set of cities.
To both points.
And I draw in those lines. Now it turns out that from Santa Barbara, I only allowed one road at the way I've drawn it here on this map. And so I can only look from LA and I find those nearest sites. This is a little imprecise, but this is the idea. Then you branch out from those nearest sites and find the next nearest ones, and so on. Where by nearest, I mean the total distance starting from Santa Barbara. So what happens is that at each intersection, you end up assigning a number which is the minimal distance from that city to Santa Barbara, or from Santa Barbara to that city. So first you have a label here, it's about 100 miles. Then you label San Francisco, it's about 700. You know, 200 here or whatever, and you keep on building up, and you find the cities that are just further than the nearest distance you found so far. And what you do by this is you build up what's called a spanning tree, a minimal spanning tree that covers all of the U.S. in this case, and this actually solves the nearest distance problem between Santa Barbara and any place in the U.S. Because I label every intersection, or, you know, where by place I mean intersection or city, and I label every city with the distance from Santa Barbara.
It seems like it grows exponentially in distance.
It doesn't grow exponentially in distance because I never, once the city's added to the list, that's it, I'm done with it. And so I only have to visit each city once because each time I add an edge to this tree, I am claiming inductively that I have found the shortest way to get from Santa Barbara to that city. And so it says I have to only visit each city once. It's actually a linear time, except there's some sorting that you have to keep track of. So there's some log n type of stuff floating around. But it's linear in the number of nodes.
So every time you're at a node, you only need to inspect out from that node typically a small number of directions.
Right. So each node, you only look at nearest neighbors. But you only add the nearest neighbors if they are the closest thing on your frontier. So what you do is you build up a frontier, and on your frontier, you have a distance to Santa Barbara. And you add to your frontier those that can be reached in minimal distance from your current frontier.
The map you've drawn is a DP-like, but surely we'll find loops.
You'd find loops only if things were degenerate, and so I'm going to assume there's no degeneracy here. So suppose I get out to this point, I find that this is the shortest distance to here, and this is the shortest distance to here. And I'd form a loop by going from here to here, or something like that. But I don't do that because when I added each of these to my frontier, those were the minimally reachable sites at that kind of barrier on the frontier. So I've already asserted that I cannot reach this point faster than the distance I've already assigned to it. So maybe I should have gone through this more formally.
It is exponential in the dimensional breakdown.
No, it's not exponential in anything. Not exponential in the dimension. It's just exponential in the number of nodes. In the number of nodes.
It's linear.
It's linear in the number of nodes, right.
But it has to be repeated for every city. I mean, the information from Santa Barbara has to be rebuilt if you're traveling from Dallas, or is there any way you can reuse the information?
You can reuse the information to a certain extent, and so computer scientists will worry about that. You know, how can I reuse this information? So I construct one minimal spanning tree. How can I use that information to assist me in constructing, say, a minimal spanning tree starting at Dallas. And there is some savings you can do there. But in the crudest sense, constructing all minimal distance pairs is n squared, because I can just repeat this procedure. So it's still polynomial to construct the whole table of nearest distances for between any pair of cities. So it's on its face polynomial, but you can improve the polynomial somewhat. Okay, so here's what MapQuest does. This is how you find the shortest distance between two points in a non-flat geometry. Now, why should a physicist care about this? Besides driving someplace to give a talk or something like this. The shortest path is going to be, of course, the lowest energy state of an extended object in a disordered background. So, for example, a vortex line in a type 2 superconductor. So if I had some superconductor with defects in it, let's say the line prefers to cross through defects, and as Thierry talked in very nicely about, was it two, 3 weeks ago now? Anyway, I talked about the interface problem is optimizing this, a competition between the elastic energy, which wants to stretch out the flux line, and the energy you can gain by diverting the flux line to find favorable defects points. So you might consider a vortex line as type 2 superconductors. There's a dual problem, and it turns out that many of these problems are directly related to each other by very simple mappings of, say, breaking a porous rock into two pieces, at least a two-dimensional rock. Suppose these are pores that cost low energy to break, and you want to fracture into two pieces. This is the surface of least energy to fracture the rock into two pieces. So maybe if you're interested in that, that may not actually be the way a rock breaks. A rock probably doesn't break along the minimal energy surface. But you might be interested in that question for other reasons. So you could apply this algorithm in two dimensions at least to find the optimal way to break a rock. Okay, and as many of us know, if you look at the statistics of this, for example, you might characterize the solutions to this problem. So you generate many rocks or many flux lines in two dimensions. And you look at the width of this line, how much does it wander as a function of the length of the sample, and it scales in a particular fashion as L to the power zeta, where zeta is now proven to be 2/3. It's an exact result, but it was inspired initially by this simulation by Hughes and Henley. They went into the simulation and they found a number close to 2/3. And people realized that they could explain what that number was. And so that's one thing. So simulation gives us some inspiration to look for exact results. Another thing is that if you come from the computer science side, it gives us some information about optimal paths, power law, at least if I talk to some computer scientists and mathematicians, wasn't obvious that it should even scale this way. Now it's been proven by mathematicians that this is the case. But these connections between power laws suggested on physical principles, as this originally was, I think gives some motivation to that community to address particular problems. Yes?
I'm sorry.
Maybe I'm going too fast. Sure.
Well, how the problem is formally.
Okay.
Suppose I have a leg.
Yes. Okay,
let's. Leg.
Yes.
And then I want to put certain distance between each two sides.
Yes. Each neighboring pair has some random cost between it, say, yes.
Is it within this class of problems, or you're considering problems when number of nearest neighbors also changes and they have to do some percolation cluster?
I could do either one of them with this algorithm. So I could, so sort of fixed lattice geometry with random positive costs along each edge, I could find the distance between any two pair of points in a polynomial time. If I'm looking at a more complicated geometry, a different number of nearest neighbors, or a porous, or something sitting on a fractal, or some sort of percolation network, you could also solve it in polynomial time. Polynomial in the number of edges and the number of nodes.
I can see some solutions already.
Oh, yes. Oh.
Distribution,
oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's be a little careful about that. So this is some relatively well-behaved distribution for the edge costs. If the edge costs have a very large distribution, say a distribution that grows in width, particularly with the size of the lattice, Yeah, you'd like the second moment to exist probably, right? I'm not 100% sure that's actually required. I have to think about that. Certainly, people have looked at the case where if you make it a very broad distribution, that the breadth grows with the size of the system, then things do change. Because then it becomes more of a bottleneck problem where you want to find the short, you know, the place that is optimal to pass through, and then you'll have a different dimension. That's true.
And how it connects with the problem of resistance of the random network? Is it similar or?
People have tried to make some connections. There are some connections with resistance to a random network, I suppose, but that's a different problem because that's a diffusion type of problem, where this is an optimization type of problem. So, this is a different type of mathematics. I think that's one of the things that, you know, physicists find when they start working in this area. It's not involving diffusion. It's not involving solving PDEs. It's something where you really want the best thing, and the best thing doesn't necessarily tell you about all the whole spatial distribution of things. So over time, a certain industry has been built up around applying algorithms to disordered materials, looking at things like flux lines in superconductors, interfaces in magnets, spin glasses, and so on. And you start by finding a mapping to graph problems. Lots of the fun in this field has been taking problems that don't have an obvious interpretation as a graph problem, and then finding that interpretation, and then being able to apply algorithms. You're particularly happy if you can find a fast and exact ground state algorithm. And most of what I'm going to talk about today is done for systems where there are polynomial time algorithms. So you have a fast, exact algorithm to find the ground state. So it's fast, you save time, and you know it's the only solution. No one's ever going to beat you because you've got the exact solution. And I think part key understanding this approach, and I'm going to talk about the hard problems too, but I want to start talking about simple problems. Those are tractable, those are solvable. If you avoid the minima that you get stuck in a Glassig problem by using non-physical approximate or intermediate solutions. What do I mean by that? If you go back and think about building these routes for the shortest distance between two points, the intermediate stages of that algorithm are not a path that connects Santa Barbara and Syracuse, which is what you use in simulated annealing. That's a physical approach where you have a path that connects two points and you let it fluctuate and try to find the optimal configuration. Here we're cheating, we're being more clever, and we're using intermediate steps that are not physical solutions. Often, those intermediate solutions, when they become the physical solution, then you know you're done with the algorithm. That's the criteria for stopping. And one other thing I want to emphasize is many of these techniques work by finding paths. And I think that if you think about the types of problems that you can solve, they are things where you can find paths, because that's what graph theory is about. It's about finding paths. It's very hard to find surfaces, minimum cost or maximum cost surfaces. Well, minimum cost surfaces you can, but in general you can find maximum or minimum cost paths fairly easily. And a lot of algorithms are built on ideas that start from this idea of just finding paths, like for this example of the minimum route. Yes?
Any idea of how much time does it take to simulate the annealing to solve the minimum path?
How long does simulated annealing take to find a minimum path? Typically, it's going to be exponential in the system size, if you want the exact solution, because the barriers grow with the exponential of the system size, typically. I mean, not the barriers grow, but the barriers grow as a power law, and the simulated annealing, you need to go over barriers of that order, and so there's typical thermal activation time that scales exponentially in some power of the system size.
I thought simulated annealing, you need that by starting at a really high temperature and then gradually working your way down. So at any given time, your temperature is comparable to the energy barrier, or comparable.
Yeah, so the optimistic approach to simulated annealing is what you just said, that as you cool down, that the barriers you find are only those that are the size of the system. But I don't think it's the way it really works, right? I don't know what the best results are, or really the state of the art, results are for that. But it's exponential. Yes, that's generally what's believed to be true. So I was lucky they didn't know about simulated annealing. That's right, we'd be wasting a lot of time. Well, it depends on the size of the problem. Simulated annealing is very good for some moderate sized problems. And it's very easy to program. That's another advantage, of course. So I want to review a little bit some of the results that have been accumulated over time about what is tractable. And again, we've had some introduction to this, but let me review this, because I think it's good to think about this in perspective. And what I really want to emphasize is that the distinction between polynomial and MP hard problems can be very subtle. So over here I've written a list of things that are polynomial, that is where there are algorithms that are known that will find, that will solve your problem, generate an optimal solution, for example, in time that's polynomial in the number of degrees of freedom in your system. Okay, polynomial could be of large degree. See, this is why computer scientists, you know, classify things as we have, is that just as polynomial, it's good, but polynomial could be n to the hundredth or something like this. But typically, worst case bounds are rarely greater than n cubed for problems of physical interest. And practically, the algorithms in practice take time that's often nearly linear in the size of the system to find the ground state or to solve some other question. So things that fall into this class are the ground state, the full partition function, anything you want to know about the two-dimensional Edward Anderson spin glass. So with these degrees of freedom, all the interactions are between a spin's line and a plane. A partition function for the 2D elastic medium with periodic pinning, like Giammarco was speaking about. Percolation, we were so used to thinking about that as a physics problem, but really is a basic computer science problem, and that's certainly in P. This class of problems can be solved in polynomial time. Any number of dimensions, you have many non-intersecting lines in a random potential, so that's vortex lines like in the superconductor, and you just forbid them from intersecting, but they've got to optimize their energy. So for example, everyone wants to drive from the west coast to the east coast, and they don't want to cross paths, and you get a set of lines that goes across the United States, and that's an optimization problem that can be solved in polynomial time in the number of degrees of freedom and the number of paths. So something like vortex lines with highly screened interactions in a superconductor can be solved in polynomial time in any in arbitrary dimension. Say finding the connected cluster or something like this, determining whether you have a spanning cluster from one side to the other. It's a very simple problem. It's called reachability in computer science, and it's the one you usually start with, and as we often do in physics, that's where we start discussing disordered systems. MP hard problems, those which have no known polynomial time algorithm, in fact, are believed to be exponentially hard. Though no one's proven it yet, as we always keep on reminding ourselves, are something like two-dimensional layers of the Ising spin glass that are coupled to each other. So if you have Ising spin glass in two dimensions, it's solvable in polynomial time. If you have two layers that are coupled to each other, Barahona showed that you cannot solve it in polynomial time. So even though it looks like a two-dimensional system, it's no longer known to be solvable in polynomial time. It's an MP hard problem. We don't. It belongs to this particular class of problems called MP hard problems, which is strongly believed to be something you can't do in polynomial time, and no one knows how to do it in polynomial time. Yeah, if you prove that P, yeah, that's right. So this is P not equal MP thing, right? So for example, in a random bond magnet, that is, if you have spins that are connected to each other by random JIJs that are positive. Unlike the spin glass where they can be negative, they're only connected by positive bonds. You can find ground state and domain walls in the random bond magnet in polynomial time, but you can't find the highest energy state in polynomial time. That's particularly as emphasized by Israel recently, you cannot do that. Coulomb glass ground state is something that's MP hard. You can show that the barrier to the motion of a loop in a plane is MP hard. And the reason I mentioned this, and for example this, is that for the same system, some questions can be solved in polynomial time and some are NP hard. So when we start asking questions about the energy landscape of a system, you might find that you can find the ground state quickly, but you can't find the highest energy state in a reasonable amount of time. You might be able to learn a lot about the system, but you can't find the barrier between two configurations. So this system, for example, you can find the ground state in a reasonable amount of time, but you can't find the barrier to its motion in a reasonable amount of time. Yes, Pierre. Potts model in two dimensions? Potts spin glass in two dimensions. I don't recall, honestly. The Potts glass in two dimensions is the same as spin easing.
The same thing about this thing, we just assume that some of the interactions are happen to be two or something like that.
Oh, that's right. So two layers is like, you could think of it as a four state system with nearest neighbor interactions. Right. And
no, because you've got new interactions in the second plane.
I mean, also, well, it's also like having a, but also the two layers, if you try to formulate that way, it's like having a magnetic field. And the Ising spin glass in two dimensions, the magnetic field is hard. So, because if you start talking about the couplings between the layers, I think you get effectively a magnetic field because some energy states are favored over others without worrying about interactions with nearest neighbors. So you might think of that. So the whole point of this is it's really sensitive to what the problem is. Yeah, Greg. Yes. Yes, well, MP hard, yeah, this is this technicality. So what's the difference between MP and MP hard? MP is formulated in terms of decision problems. Yes, no questions, that's how it's what MP is. MP hard is a problem that's at least as hard as any NP decision problem. So an NP decision problem might be, the ground state energy lies less than K, some cutoff. And that's a decision problem. Finding what the actual energy is an optimization problem, and to classify those problems, use terminology like NP hard. So NP hard is at least as hard as any NP decision problem. Yes. Yes. That's right. So like by bisection, you can translate NP hard problems, many of them into NP problems, set of decision problems. Okay. Sorry. Well, they're at least as hard as NP complete problems. That's the point. They're as hard as NP complete problems. They're at least as hard as NP complete problems. Yeah.
What is the barrier to motion of loop in a plane?
Okay, barrier to motion of loop in a plane. Okay, so let me explain that. Thank you. It's like if you have a loop in a plane with disorder, and you want to start it in some state and end it in some state through a sequence of elementary plaquette flips or something like this on the lattice. So you move the loop around through local moves, and you want to find the barrier between one spot and the other. So if you're concerned about thermal activation or something like that, you would actually determine what the barrier is. Computing the barrier can be NP hard, even though finding the ground state can be polynomial.
That would be useful, for example, if you were looking to grow a sheet of atoms.
Absolutely. So if you want to do something like grow a sheet of atoms over some random potential or something like that, then this would apply to that. So one of the things about NP hard problems here is that one of the outstanding questions, of course, is Martin Veit talked a bit about, is can one do better typically? That is, this classification is a worst case scenario. That is, the worst, nastiest problem in these class of things is known to be, is believed to be hard. But maybe the physical systems we look at aren't so. Generally, that's not the case. Generally, they turn out to be hard, at least with the techniques we know about. But it's something to keep on thinking about. One can look for good heuristics to try to approximate these solutions as best as solutions to these problems as best as possible, as non-exact methods, approximations. There's a lot of work in that area. And one of the things here then is, what is the difference between, if the difference at least to the physicist's eye, between P and MP hard is so subtle, does that have physical implications? And that's always been an outstanding question in this connections between physics and computational complexity is, does this really make a difference to the physics, this classification? It certainly makes a difference to the physicist, because you can study these problems more easily than here, but does it make a difference to the physics? And that's an open problem. Ah, just beat the screensaver there. Okay, so what can we learn from studying polynomial time problems? I'm going to focus on those because you can do a lot with them rapidly. So you can check quantitative predictions. For example, as I hope we're going to hear about, are we going to hear the details of this next week? Okay, we'll hear the details of this next week. You can, there's some very nice higher loop order functional renormalization group calculations for things like the roughness, the exponent zeta, the roughness of an interface in a non-periodic pinning system. Or you might look at, if you have periodic pinning, amplitudes for how the distortions grow as a function of separation of two points. So I hope, if you have any questions about this, please ask. This is just, I hope, it's somewhat familiar from earlier talks. But there's some very precise predictions. Okay. So, okay. I even gave you a hint as to what epsilon was. Okay, so this is something like, if you have an interface, a scalar displacement, some u of x, this is x, your dimension, or you know, more than one dimension, particularly in one direction, you have some interface which has a displacement. And so we're asking questions about the roughness of this interface. That's this exponent zeta. How does this width scale as dimension L, like with the directed polymer problem? RMS width, right.
And D is the dimension of X.
And D is the dimension of X, correct.
So that whole system
right. Okay, is D plus one. This is D plus one, that's absolutely true. So this is X, which is in, well, we'll pretend it's real space, so it's always discretized on the computer, okay, but they worry about real space. Anyway, and so U of X is the correlation function between two points, the square, the expected square variation over some length scale, x.
And what is, which equation governs the shape?
Okay, so the what governs this, sorry, is the, this was in talk last week, and a couple weeks ago, this has some disorder in it. And so you're trying to find the optimum interface again. So there's some sort of interface, like before we found the optimal path, which is a line that went through a disordered medium. Now we have a surface which goes through a disordered medium, and we want to find the optimal shape for that, for example. And we're looking at the correlation functions that describe the roughness of that interface, say in 2 plus 1 dimensions or something like this, or 3 plus 1 dimensions. And there are two cases here, one where the pins are randomly distributed throughout the media, and the other where there's a periodicity in the u direction, so that the pins are periodic in this direction. And that results from modeling things like flux lattices in superconductors or something like this, where you have an energy that's periodic in the displacement of the elastic medium. So you might be interested in checking these predictions very carefully. And there's a lot more work to be done there, particularly as the predictions have gotten more precise. And I think that one can look at, try to determine things more accurately. But the problem is the predictions are relatively close. Like Giamarchi mentioned, the Flory exponents and the functional renormalization group exponents, and they're fairly close to each other. So it's going to take, and if you look at the numerics, they could be interpreted as agreeing with any of them at this point. So you could say that we can do some better numerics, which we can now do probably, to check these stronger theoretical predictions more carefully. So one of the things you could do is go around and check exponents. And this gives you some confidence that the theoreticians know what they're doing when they're doing the analytic work. Another type of thing is you might look at more qualitative concepts. That is, as I'm going to show you, we can do such large-scale systems that we can ask much more qualitative questions about the structure of the excitations and the ground states and the energy landscape in these disordered systems. And it's to address things like the number of thermodynamic states, at least in these systems that can be studied in polynomial time and finite dimension. Another connection that I want to make here is the performance of the algorithm. How well does the algorithm perform in different parts of the phase diagram for these disordered systems? And how can we connect that to length scales and phase transitions? So I'll hope to make that clear as we go, more clear as we go along. Any questions about this so far? So what I want to do is look at a specific example here to show you an application of these polynomial time algorithms beyond this shortest path problem. So here is this picture, except now drawn up there, which shows this green line is supposed to be the outline of some sort of elastic interface. This is a 2+1 dimensional problem where there's displacements u in this direction, up and down direction. And these little red dots are to signify pins that are periodic. They're supposed to be evenly spaced like this, that interact with the interface. So here we're going to look at periodic pins and look at the membrane energy. Well, the first thing you want to do when you put it on the computer is discretize it. So we'll discretize it by imagining that this is really approximated with the 1-1-1 surface of a cubic lattice. And you look down upon, now looking down upon that interface, you see this, and you project it down to the plane, it makes these rhombic tiles. If you think of this as, these are the corners of cubes here. Is this clear enough here? Okay. No? Okay, so if I think of a cube, you look at it from the corner, it looks like this. So if I think of a crystal, and I stack cubes up, and then I look at it from the 1-1-1 direction, I can imagine lifting the cubes out and putting them in to create an interface of arbitrary shape on that cubic lattice. And so here's a cube, say, pointing up, with corner up, and then this would be a valley or something like this. So this is looking down upon a set of cubes oriented in the 1-1-1 direction, so oriented to form a, arranged in such a way as to make an interface. You can use different things. You can use, yes. Well, cubic interface is often used to discretize. Which particular thing? There are many. You can do this in different ways. There are different.
There are people who are doing things in quantum gravity.
Yes. Right.
They usually use triangulation.
Right.
And people who are doing three-dimensional.
Right. You can use different polytopes. There's nothing special about cubic. You can use different ones. In fact, I'll show you in another example in a moment where you use a different tiling. This is on lattice. That's the other. Yes, that's another point. But
and the reason you're doing it on lattice is the pins are periodic.
You're doing it on lattice because the pins are periodic. That helps.
You're approximating that periodic potential by making these guys.
That's right.
Discrete integer values.
You can certainly have different choices for the discretization, and the claim is universality would mean that you'd still get the same results.
Is there some simple matching rule here so that the surface is a physical one and not an Escher print?
What do you mean it's not an Escher print?
That's not impossible.
I mean, this is actually possible geometrically. You can't go around a circle going upstairs.
Oh, definitely, yes. I mean, if you draw this rhombic tiles, as I've drawn here, if the tiles are well packed, there's no singularity. There's no defect. You can actually study the system with height defects, but that's another talk.
I think I meant something slightly different. I want you to make sure that I can't go around the loop stepping upwards all the way.
That's what I mean. But so there's nothing with the Burgers vector. If you put these tiles like this, a rhombic tiling, it really is in one-to-one correspondence with some set of cubes that form a surface. And if you go around any loop and stepping up and down, your total height difference around loop is zero, guaranteed to be so. It's a solid-on-solid model.
But you add random energies.
That's right. But the point is that there are going to be random energies, as John says, for different tilings here, different cubes, because of the variation in energy. But it's going to be periodic so that if I see, anyway, let me go on here a little bit here. So now what you can do is you can take these rhombuses, and I just wanted, this is just all geometric. This is very simple mathematically. You can map the surfaces into, so I just draw little short segments along the long axes of these rhombi. And it turns out that all of those axes are going to lie on a hexagonal or a honeycomb lattice. And so there's a one-to-one mapping then between matchings or dimer coverings on this honeycomb lattice and these cubic faces. Okay, so this is standard tricks that people use in quantum systems to study them, or statistical mechanics of, you know, making correspondences between dimer models, which you could solve analytically and solid models. But the difference here is we're going to assign a different weight to each of these edges. So the energy of this particular configuration is going to be the sum of the weights of each of these edges that it participate. And each edge has a different energy. So this edge has an energy, this edge has an energy, this edge has an energy. They all have different energies, random energies associated with them. And the energy of the matching is going to be the sum of the edges that are in the matching, the sum of the energies of the edges that are in the matching. Yes?
It seems like when you do this mapping, you have to be quite careful about the distribution of those energies so that you reproduce the original problem. But, I mean, presumably in the original problem, the periodic pinning has a band and phase that you want to be uniform.
Yes, yes.
And that presumably has some non-trivial implications.
I think once again that that's something that I think we're not going to worry about it. I'm going to claim it doesn't matter. We can argue about that. I mean, you'll get some short-range correlations that way, but I don't think it makes a big difference.
I'm worried about worse than that. If you have a random cosine,
yes,
yes, that random phase is uniformly distributed. That's
yes,
one problem.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
Random phase is non-uniformly distributed, so it has peaks in certain directions.
Yes.
Then obviously there's a component of that that's acting like a uniform field phase in certain special directions in the physics.
Yes. Yes.
It's going to be as different as the physics of a ferromagnetic intermagnetic.
Yeah. Well, you can do that. You can solve that problem. You can just attach different weights. You can make all the vertical dimers have different weights. You know, bias them in some way. So you can actually include those types of things if you like.
But what I'm worried about is that you might put them in accidentally if you're not careful about the distribution. We'll talk about that.
We'll talk about that later. Maybe. Yeah. I think. Yes. Okay, because I'm going to run over today, okay? People can feel free to. So what I want to do now is, because originally these were supposed to run an hour and a half roughly. Anyway, so okay. What if, and what I want to emphasize here also is that if you take this matching, a matching is something that where I lay edges that don't intersect each other, that cover all the nodes on this lattice, and I take away all the vertical ones, and wherever there's a vertical one missing, I put in a vertical one. So I take out this vertical one, I cross it out, and then I put in vertical bonds here, and I do that throughout, I get a set of lines. And again, this is familiar from, this is a random line that should have been taken out. This should not be there. It should be X'd. But this converts the dimer problem into lines in a multiple background. I mean, multiple lines in a disordered background. So I'm just showing you geometrically, the energy transformation is pretty straightforward. But you can say, I want to study many lines in a disordered background in two dimensions, and I'm going to assign weights for the line to pass through each of these points, and the energy of the line is going to be the sum of the weights along that path, and I can ask, what is the ground state of that system? And it turns out it's directly related to this one. The point is this is the central problem, this matching problem, which is a bipartite matching problem. That is, the lattice is bipartite. There's these red, these white, and these black circles. Each edge connects a black and a white circle. There are very fast algorithms that exist for this assignment problem. You could do old PC means a few hundred, couple hundred megahertz. You could solve a million sites in 40 seconds, roughly. So, I guess what I want you to get from this is there's a dimer problem, it matches onto a height problem. You can then use this algorithm to solve the dimer problem to find the optimal state. If you know about solving Ising models or Castellan and Fortuin and these mapping to dimer problems, if all the weights are uniform, you can find the partition function of the system by diagonalizing the matrix. Here I'm saying if the weights vary, then there's an optimal configuration. The optimal configuration can be found by this particular black box algorithm. Okay. So I'm not going to get the details of. Yes.
I don't understand. What's the quantity you want to minimize in the Dimer problem?
The Dimer problem, okay, so let me write this down. I should have written this down a bit more formally. Let me do this. So the total energy of the Dimer problem is the sum over edges that are in the matching. That is, these are the edges that are in the matching. There are all the edges in the problem of the weights of those edges. And that's what I want to optimize. Okay. So this is something you can do in less than a second or two. This is, now I'm put this on a square lattice. It's different, I've cheated, I've changed the rules on you. But there's a similar thing you can do. Like I say, you can do many different lattices. This is a matching on a square lattice, so each edge connects two points. And this is guaranteed to be the optimal energy for the arrangement of these edges, given this metric, this energy being the sum of the edge weights. You can then do something like go back and transform that into a height field following rules similar to what I just gave you. So red is supposed to be high height, blue is supposed to be low height, and this is a height, the field that corresponds to this matching. And then you can compute correlation functions here. So this now is an interface in a periodic pinning system, and you can calculate the correlation functions and compare them with theory.
Okay.
How you do what?
How you manage to find
it. How do I find the dimers? No, I'm not going to tell you how to find the dimers. I'll tell you another thing. So I've told you one thing. I've told you about shortest paths. I'll tell you another algorithm towards the end of the talk. But this one, I don't want to. It's going to take more time than we have. Now, what you can do then is measure the structure function of this, and you find that if you measure the structure function, that it diverges as log q, as if you measure s of q versus log q, you see some short range minus log q. Right, no log q. You see some high frequency stuff here, and then a straight line here. And that means that this interface is rougher than if it were thermal, because if it were thermal, you'd have white noise at small frequencies, and you'd have S of Q would go to a constant. But it goes up linearly with Q, which suggests that the width of this interface, as predicted by a theorist starting with Cardi and Usselin some time ago, the width goes as, if you want to measure as a function of frequency, I'm sorry, as x log r squared, the width goes as this log of the separation squared. And that's just one result. What I'm trying to give you here is a flavor of the types of problems you can attack rather than the exact results. So I'll give you some for the random field magnet in a moment. So there's an application to studying particular systems. Now, does laziness lead to a big ego? Well, what I mean here is we're looking at ground states. We're looking at things that have low energy. Are they unique? Is the solution to an optimization problem unique in some sense? And this is connected to the question of how many states are there in the thermodynamic limit? How many thermodynamic states are there for a disordered system? So, a ground state in thermodynamic limit is something that's stable to flips of finite clusters. That means if I take an infinitely large system and I say, I don't know if I want to spend too much time on this particular point, but let me just put this down as a refresher for something that is keep in mind of what a ground state is. And here we're looking at ground states because we're looking at zero temperature. And the question is, are there ground states in the thermodynamic limit that are not related by global symmetries? Originally, this came up in the context of spin glasses, where the question is there a single pair of globally flipped states that are related to each other, and those are the two ground states, or are there many states that are that contribute in the thermodynamic limit to the large volume. So if you think of a magnet where the spins interact with each other so they all want to line up, the answer is there are two pure states in the thermodynamic limit, all the spins up or all the spins down. Where you have interactions between spins that are much more complicated, that are random and depend upon spatial position, it's much less clear what's going on. Now,
perfect finite system.
Yes.
Could it be the case that in any finite system there is a unique ground state up with respect to the global symmetries? But as you take the thermodynamic limit, there are many states within 1 over L. You know,
right. For finite, for the questions I'm going to look at, we're going to choose distributions for the disorder that mean that in any finite sample there's a unique ground state. And so the question is, if you take the infinite volume limit, is that still the case? In that, in the sense that you mentioned, that maybe the gap gets smaller as you go to larger systems, and so then therefore there's more, so there are many minima that are nearby in energy. And you would see those at finite temperature, certainly, you'd see that these other states entering into correlation functions of thermodynamic averages or something like this. Okay, so to address this question, one can actually take the limit of larger and larger systems and watching the correlation functions in a finite volume, or just taking a system and changing the boundaries and seeing what happens in the interior. In particular, this has been pursued for spin glasses and related systems by Newman and Stein, where they've set down a whole program of different ways to test some of these claims. Some rigorous results and some less, but strong arguments. And it's good to have a numerical check to look at some of these questions and address them for things besides spin glasses. But I'm going to start with spin glasses in two dimensions here.
Now,
yes?
Is there a way to define many states at non-zero temperature?
Yes, you can define many states at non-zero temperature. You can say, again, so many states is that, let's see, so non-zero temperature, I have to shift a little bit. I mean, you still, it's a question of, if you measure correlation functions or something like this, can you express those correlation functions as sum over just a couple of different pure states, or are there many states that could contribute to those sums? Yeah, Pierre, yeah. This definition, you don't necessarily have to compare the energy of the different ground states. That's right. And there certainly is some, okay, I have to think about that. Maybe we should discuss that a little bit more as I give you some of these results and we can talk about what that would mean for finite temperature. Because what I'm going to give you are zero temperature results. This here, yes. Yes. Yeah, so this is the definition of what a ground state is. In finite temperature, you have to worry about, again, like I say, I just have to think about this abstractly and think of, okay, you have these, what is a pure state? And anyway, I mean, I have to think hard about that to remind myself of those details. Yes.
Temperature, you tend to just use the Gaussian function, and then take extremal form. It could be a definition of pure state.
Okay, since I'm running shorter on time, I mean, I think that this is a good question. But the finite temperature stuff, why don't we hold off on until, so let me just deal with the ground state question for now. And a lot of the conceit or conception has been that that zero temperature is a good place to look because the stuff is controlled by zero temperature behavior, that the finite temperature is irrelevant, at least below the phase transition. So let's look at the zero temperature case to start with.
What is the gap between ground state and how it scales in the
There are some ideas about how, I mean, the first excited state is always, there's always a local excited state that's low in energy. If I just flip a single spin, I can always get a low energy excitation. The question is what are the large scale excitations? Let me tell you about the program here, the numerical work, and to give you an idea of what you can do to start to address these questions, which are really subtle in the end. They're very subtle. You have to think about all these different permutations of limits and things like this. Let me start with a sample that's of size L. That's this dashed line here. And in this sample, I'm going to find the ground state configuration. And so I've drawn an example here for a two-dimensional spin glass. I find the exact ground state configuration. If I look at that ground state configuration, it looks random. There's a bunch of plus and minus spins because, so this is an Edward Anderson spin glass where you have random interactions between nearest neighbors. The JIJs can be positive or negative, and they're taken to be Gaussian distributed. Does anyone have a question about what the model is? Everyone's happy with the Edward Anderson spin glass with Gaussian interactions. Okay. Find the ground state configuration. Then you expand the system by adding more spins on the outside. This is a way to change the boundaries. It's a way of thinking about taking the infinite volume limit. You find the ground state configuration again. Again, it'll be a whole bunch of pluses and minuses that don't look like anything in particular. But when you compare them, of course, you compare the bonds, which bonds are satisfied and which are unsatisfied between the two samples, and you'll find that you introduce these defect lines.
So when you expanded the system, you didn't change any of the bonds inside?
Did not change any of the bonds in the interior in this L by L area when I expanded the system. So it's like physically growing the system, adding more random spins on the outside.
Can you find a new ground state for the whole system?
I find a ground state for the new system, the whole new system, not worrying about the fact that there was originally a subsystem in there. And then you compare the bonds, you find which ones have changed relative sign, that is, bonds that were satisfied and are now unsatisfied or vice versa, and you get lines like this. And so what that means is on either side of the line, this spin configuration might have been the same as it originally was, and then if that were the case, it's flipped on the other side. So you've introduced a domain wall, a spin glass domain wall, into the system. The global ground state. It's an exact global ground state for two-dimensional spin glass, which you can solve. Huh? Yeah, right. So the global one in each case, both for L and L prime. You find the exact global ground state in both cases. Then you compare them, and you find these domain walls that have been created. And then you look at some place in the interior, and you see whether the domain wall crosses there. Because one of the things Newman and Stein have emphasized, other people have emphasized, is if this happens a lot, that a domain wall crosses the interior as you grow the system larger and larger, you're not converging to a unique ground state. But if, as you grow the system larger and larger, it doesn't cross the interior infinitely often, then you have evidence that you are converging to a unique ground state, and that the interior configuration up to global spin flips, in this case, is independent of boundary conditions in the infinite volume limit. So in this case, being lazy would give you a large ego. Okay.
So I just want to make sure I understand the domain wall here. It's not the usual domain wall with separating upspins and downspins. It's just the line where things
have changed. It's the line where things have changed. So this looks like a mess. It's pluses and minuses. It's pluses and minuses. But these pluses and minuses are flipped relative to what they were before you grew the system.
Are in a given state, then it would be a domain wall.
That's right. That's right.
So these systems have to be extended across, and you could have suddenly little islands.
That's right, because if you had an island in the interior, that's right. So she's asking, could there be an island in the interior? Then that would mean you hadn't found the true ground state. And that's a useful way to debug your algorithm, which has come up in the past. So if you find a loop in the interior, that means originally you could have flipped the spins and lowered the energy in the interior. And so you didn't find the true ground state. So the lines have to cross, have to touch at the edges. So what I want to show you now, I'm going to measure an event. An event is a domain wall crosses this window. I'm going to measure the probability of that event when I take the system from size L, double it to 2L, and look in a window centered at the origin. All these areas or volumes are centered at the origin of linear size W. I want to see how that probability of that event changes with this scaling quantity here, L over W. So just to remind you, L is this, W is this. So the original volume to the window volume, I want to see how it changes with now. Yes. No, the spins in the window aren't fixed. The bonds are fixed. The JIJs are fixed within L by L, or L cubed if I'm doing a three-dimensional system. And I look at the probability of a change in that window as the original system volume increases. Now, there's a couple of things here. These are for four different possible things. The 2D spin glass, the 2D matching, which is equivalent to the 2D interface in a periodic pinning. The 3D interface in non-periodic pinning, and then the matching, which actually doesn't correspond in three dimensions like it does in two. So here's four different polynomial time problems chosen from two dimensions and three dimensions that have physical, this is vortex lines, for example. 3D matching can be mapped onto vortex lines. And this is the probability of a change in the configuration as you grow the system. As the system becomes larger, as this L over W becomes larger, the probability decreases, which would indicate, if you believe the extrapolation to larger and larger numbers, that this number goes to zero. And therefore, you converge to a unique configuration in the interior.
The probabilistic aspect coming from
that. Right, so there are many different disorders. And so you run this for 10,000 samples or something like this at each combination of sizes. And you estimate a probability then for the change. Yes?
What type of boundary conditions do you use for the...
It depends on the system. Most of these are open boundary conditions.
And does these things depend whether you find your ground states by imposing open boundary conditions or imposing a reality boundary condition?
Okay. I haven't checked it in detail for all these cases, but I've checked it in some cases. And it doesn't matter whether you use periodic or open. The program, this type of approach, relies upon the boundary conditions not being chosen according to the disorder. You can't do that, because then you're picking very particular boundary conditions. But under generic boundary conditions, all of this turns out to be the same, whether it's periodic or open or fixed even. No, I haven't done, no. We talked about that. So. So this goes down with growing system size, which suggests that you're approaching a unique state. Now, in particular, these lines that are drawn here are not fits to the data. In fact, it's kind of not so great in a couple places here, but they're plausible. These slopes are actually given by the fractal dimension of a single domain wall minus the dimensionality of the system. And I won't go through the argument here now, but if you believe that when you change the boundary conditions significantly, you introduce order one domain wall each time you do that, then the probability of the domain wall crossing the window should scale in this fashion. Depends upon the fractal dimension of the domain wall compared with the dimensionality of the system. So this is the probability of a single domain wall intersecting this interior volume, this window volume, as you grow the system size.
Sorry, so you're saying that's the prediction if you assume that you double the system size, you introduce one domain wall.
That's right. If you introduce one domain wall and you double the system size, that would be the prediction, that you should get that slope. Because it's a fractal, and DF being less than D means that it's not space filling. The domain wall is not space filling, and so the probability goes down as you grow the system size. No, why do I double it?
Yeah, I mean, could be that when you multiply by 20 you take the L to the cube,
mm-hmm.
then you get a completely different ground state.
You can consider that by composing these doubling operations.
Yeah, but
And so the probability, so the first time you double it, say, suppose you start here. The first time you double it, you get this probability. The next time you get the next probability, and so on. And the probability decreases, so you'll approach some finite constant as you go to the large volume of having a change. Okay, unfortunately the system is less clear for something else, like the 3D spin glass. So I've talked to you about easy problems. I want to point out that hard problems are still hard. So the latest that I'm aware of for 3D spin glasses, where they looked at open boundary conditions up to 12 cubic centimeters, they actually were not doing exactly this thing, but it's a very related type of calculation. And I should mention that Palacini and Young did a lot of the work also on 2D spin glass early on here. The data are consistent with not space-filling domain walls or interfaces, but if you have large finite size corrections, it's also consistent with the data. The point is you can't get to large system sizes enough to really test this. And for example, I want to go back here and emphasize this. If you look at something like 3D matching, which is in similar spirit to really 3D spin glass, you notice that this probability doesn't start dropping significantly below 1 until you start to exceed a system size of at least 20 or something like this. And so that it's very hard to draw conclusions from the smaller system sizes, even for this system that we can do in polynomial time. Okay. I can, or a lot of it was done with open. It doesn't matter, it turns out. Yeah. See, I'm running a bit longer than I thought. I'm going to take just a couple minutes to do the random field magnet. I'm not going to go through this a little bit quickly and then maybe have some questions here. So let me do this quickly here then. I think because I want to make a particular point here. So here's the Hamiltonian for random field magnet. You have ferromagnetic couplings between nearest neighboring Ising spins, and you have an external random field that influences the spins to point up or down. When the HIs are small, this wins. The spins tend to couple ferromagnetically, and you get a system that's magnetized. If this is large, if the external random fields are large, and they can be plus or minus, so they have mean zero, then the system is paramagnetic in that the spins orient in random directions, most strongly influenced by these external fields. Questions about this? People mostly familiar with the random field, easy magnet, I'm presuming some. You can do very large systems, say a 256 cubed, find the ground state. Here's a picture of one 64 cubed near the phase transition. You see clusters of up and down spins. These volumes here are, say, the up spins. You can find exponents, beta, theta. This, and the indications are that it's a continuous transition. Okay, now, what I want to spend a moment on is some results for the 4D RFIM, just because I have the pictures for them. The 3D results are quite similar. Here's the magnetization as a function of this disorder parameter, delta. So at large delta, where disorder is strong, the magnetization becomes small because the random external fields have the spins aligned in a particular direction. Down here, the random field is smaller. The ferromagnetic interactions between nearest neighbor spins win, and you get a net magnetization. And so in four dimensions, we can go up to, say, 64 cubed. You know, a few years, maybe we can do better, but that's what we can do right now. 64 to the fourth, I'm sorry. So that's, how many spins is that? 16 million spins or something. So those are exact ground states once again.
And delta is
what? Delta is, let me remind you here. No, please keep me honest here. Is the... This actually should be to the square root up here. So this is the RMS fluctuations in H. So it's the strength of the disorder to the ferromagnetic coupling. So when you have strong ferromagnetic coupling, you get magnetism. Otherwise, you get a paramagnetic state. And so from this, we can calculate things like the exponent mu for the transition. So this is a zero temperature transition between an ordered and a disordered state. Paramagnet may not be the best name for it, right? So, right. But it's traditional. Now, okay, I'll tell you, I will skip this. Be merciful. This what this points out here is, let me just say what the result is, and if people have questions, I can talk about it. This is looking at a similar probability that I've already discussed. And what turns out is near the transition, away from the transition on either side, the state is in the large volume limit is either given by plus or minus boundary conditions. Here, plus or minus boundary conditions on the ferromagnetic system just give you either plus or minus in the interior. over here, plus or minus boundary conditions on the outside of the volume don't influence the interior. And so what this argues is that there's one state here and there are two states here. So you can actually see a transition from one to two states in the system. The scaling works nicely. But what I wanted to get to was to look at this picture here. There's a measure of the running time, which I'll explain in a second, which is the relabels per volume. That's how much effort, computational effort, you are putting in per spin to find the ground state. So this is a measure of the computational effort per spin to find the ground state as a function of this disorder parameter. As you go to larger systems, in particular, you see a peak in the computational effort per spin to find the ground state. And that peak is at the transition. Okay, so we've seen some talks where people have talked about the transition from P to NP, from polynomial time to NP hard problems, and there's a transition there, and there's some sort of divergence in the running time, or from SAT to UNSAT is really what I should say, from SAT to UNSAT, and there's a divergence in the running time there. This is a polynomial time problem, and there's a divergence in the running time associated with it. And it happens in 3D also.
It's on and it's the same on the two sides.
Okay, now what's happening on the two sides is this is probably constant. It depends a little bit on how you do the algorithm. Some of this stuff is algorithm dependent. This is probably constant. This is logarithmic in linear size. So you got a logarithmic to constant. I'll talk about this here in a moment, what's happening here at the peak. And the running times can be understood by understanding how the algorithm grows domains in this system, which happens much faster than physically, because in the physical system you have large barriers to domain formation and so on. You can solve the RFIM. I was going to show you the approach, but I think I'm not going to... let me see what I can do here. There's an algorithm for solving it. Let me show you something that happens, and if people are curious, I can give more details. What happens is in this algorithm, there's something called a height variable. And if I just have to take a minute, if people are curious enough, I can explain it. But this height variable changes during the running of the algorithm. And the height variable is what organizes the calculations. It's what allows spins to realize that they should act as a unit together. It's a way of spreading information around in the system. And here is how, for a two-dimensional sample where there isn't a transition, but it's just easier to draw the pictures, and it's quite similar in three or four dimensions, this height variable starts out looking fairly random. It coarsens, and so this color corresponds to the magnitude of this height variable. You get this as, say, the final solution. And this is in the phase where the correlation length is larger than the system size. Here's where it's comparable. This height variable organizes over time, and you grow domains. This is an up domain in the final state, and this is a down domain. So the spins in this region are all pointing up, the spins in here are all pointing down. And that's when the algorithm is over. But while the algorithm is in this kind of non-physical state, while it's organizing itself, you get this growth of these domains. Now what it turns out is that these domains grow at the speed of light in the system, and that they grow linear, the information spreads as fast as it can because the algorithm is very efficient. And so it turns out that the height here in the interior is proportional to the size of the system. And that measure that I was showing you earlier, these relabels, are the changes in the height variable. So it turns out that the changes in the height variable are directly linked to the correlation length, the size of the volumes. This is a heuristic argument. What I'm going to claim here is that the average number of relabels is then proportional to L at the transition, where the correlation length is the size of the system. So that peak value is an indication of the correlation length. I mean, there's actually an indication of the system size. Since that criticality, you're at the correlation length, is the size of the system. And what I find absolutely shocking is if you plot this, the peak number relabel, so you do a curve fit to those peaks, and you plot them as the size of the system, you get a very nice linear fit even down to very small system sizes.
But here's the argument says this linear law is independent of dimension.
The linear law is independent of dimension, the scaling argument is, right. So it's this kind of, I mean, the point is this is kind of coarsening phenomena. It's an algorithmic coarsening. It's not a physical coarsening. This is not physical dynamics. It's algorithmic dynamics. But there's a coarsening behavior that you can match up with physical arguments and try to understand the running time of the algorithm based upon those correspondences. So I want to give you a quote here from Papadimitriou that in the first chapter of his book, when he talks about computational complexity, he mentions reachability, which a physicist should read as percolation, max flow, which is what you use to solve the random field easing magnet, and matching, which I've discussed. They're some of the happiest moments in the theory of algorithms because they're polynomial time problems, and you can do a lot with them. And of course, the NP ones are a little bit more difficult. I won't comment on any of the political implications of this stamp, given the controversy between the French and Americans over who has the copyright to that particular symbol. But okay, now I just want to summarize here by saying that P or NP hard, the distinction can be subtle. You can use, in certainly in polynomial problems, I think they're a very fun area to work in because you can find exponents and so on to a very high precision, relatively speaking. You know, 0.01, 0.02 type of uncertainties in the exponents and give you a good test of theories. You can study qualitative issues such as the number of ground states. There's much more work to be done in here, but the algorithm running time can be linked to physical ideas for these polynomial time algorithms. I mean, there's a lot of other connections here about, you know, like parallelizability as well as there's other ideas from computer science that can be connected to physical systems. Okay, so thanks.
Well, thanks very much indeed. We've had lots of questions, but let's just have a few more.
If I will ask myself the following question. Suppose I make calculation during time which is not enough to find exact ground state. I still get some solution.
Yes.
How the energy difference between this solution and real ground state will depend on time difference?
So your question is how will the energy, so if you carry out some algorithm that's searching for a ground state, you want to know what is, how far are you away from the ideal solution as a function of time, as a function of running time. Okay, for these polynomial time algorithms I've discussed, you don't even have an energy defined because you're working in this non-physical space. And so you actually can't, I think you can't really make that comparison directly. You don't have any solution. The intermediate time, while you're working away, chugging away, while the algorithm's chugging away, you don't actually have a physical solution. You're working in these intermediate variables, in these non-physical variables. Right, right.
Any distance to Syracuse.
You don't have any distance to Syracuse in the early stages of the shortest path finding algorithm. So there, it's hard to say, to make that comparison. For a lot of these other algorithms, so suppose you want to do a spin glass by simulated annealing or some other sort of heuristic technique, I don't know the answer. I mean, often it's people make various claims. I mean, I think that it should be some sort of exponential, I mean, some sort of, I mean, the, let's see, how do you work as, you know, it's this inverted exponential type of behavior. So, you know, some power, some low power of a log. Yeah, the peak there in the polynomial time algorithm, right, is distinguished between the very best and, say, some poor solution, right? Because you can always break up. Now, this is an important issue, I think, here, is you could take this algorithm, you can apply it to pieces of the system and find the exact ground state for those pieces, and that gives you a running time that scales proportional to the system size if you use the fixed size for the pieces. And so this is an idea of kind of independent parallel calculation. and you will get the energy to within, well, worst case, some surface term, best case, some sort of interface energy. And so you could then say you get it to within some power of the P size, inverse power of the P size that you approximate the solution to within a finite amount of time per spin.
In the end, it depends upon the answer to the question of on the unicity of the ground state, because if you add
that's right.
spin and you modify the structure of the ground state at the center, you cannot parallelize.
Right. And so there's a question of parallelization here. That's right. The uniqueness is intimately connected to parallelization. Absolutely. And in fact, in the random field magnet, the reason it takes a logarithm amount of time to find the ground state at that end. So if you're in the paramagnetic phase, you can solve everything locally. And so you should be able to do everything in finite amount of time per spin. On the other side, you've got to decide whether the net magnetization, so if you've got a weak magnetic field, that weak magnetic field adds up to some total magnetic field. And if the ferromagnetic couplings dominate, you either have all spins up or all spins down, depending upon the sum of those magnetic fields, if they all tend to point up or down on average. And so to solve that problem is actually logarithmic, because you have to solve the subproblems. You have to, in the best case, to find the sum of all the spins, you have to add them up hierarchically to find, and some of the external magnetic fields, you have to add them up hierarchically, and that takes logarithmic. The logarithm times the number of spins to add them all up. And so, therefore, the running time, in best case, can be logarithmic. Because you have to find the total magnetization in order to do that. At least the way it spreads information around. You could actually add them up in linear time, but the way it spreads up information around, it has to take a logarithmic amount of time to do that. Per spin.